Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. So happy to have you today on this segment of Tech Beat, where leaders learn, innovate, and grow with my esteemed friend and guest, Bassam Salem. So happy to have you on today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Earl.
Yes, of course. We're going to come back to Bassam in just a moment, but I do want to provide a few announcements, and I need to pull up my cheat sheet, if that's all right. So first of all, my name is Earl Foote. I am founder, CEO of Nexus IT. Nexus IT is a white glove outsourced IT support and cybersecurity services firm based here in Northern Utah and servicing a nationwide footprint. Nexus IT takes IT and cybersecurity off the plates of business leaders so they can focus on building their businesses and growing them instead of the intricacies of technology behind the scenes. Let's see. I did want to let everybody know that TechBeat is now on Spotify, on Apple, iHeartRadio, Google, and Pandora, and all of the other major podcast platforms. We do encourage and we would love your support there. Go subscribe. You can listen to TechBeat now in audio format or in video on any of those platforms, anywhere you are. Also, we will have some questions, a question and answer throughout the hour and at the end of the hour. So feel free, whatever platform you're joining us from, type your comments and questions into those platforms in the comments sections. We will get to as much as we can throughout the hour and at the end of the hour as well. We appreciate your support and your engagement. I did want to just update everybody on some upcoming episodes on TechBeat, some really great promising leaders that we have coming up, including James Jensen, the founder CEO of Jump, who is also the creator of The Void. He'll be joining us in August. I also have a special segment with Jake Hilliard and Eric Sessions from Intellitex. We're excited to have them join us here at the end of August. Garrett Clark and John Bowers from Silicon Slopes will be joining me in September. Tara Spalding, the managing director of Boom Startup, and Sid Tetro, the CEO of Brandless, are all joining us here on TechBeat in the coming months. So keep an eye out for announcements around those segments. All right, let's get to the man of the hour. So let me tell you just a little bit about Bassam quickly. Bassam Salem. I'm sorry. I will get my vowels
anything
right.
Anything close works for me.
I struggle a little bit because I do speak three languages, and the way you pronounce those vowels in those languages are different than in English. And so sometimes with international names, I infer.
Absolutely. Well, Salem sounds so normal. Salem sounds so much cooler.
Yeah. I lived in Salem, Massachusetts.
There you go.
I just got to remember. You know? Bassam Salem started his entrepreneurial journey by founding startup consultancy Mindshare Ventures, followed in early 2016 with the founding of Atlas RTX, the first company incubated within the Mindshare Ventures framework. The company now supports some of the world's most successful enterprises, from seven of the top 20 home builders in the United States to tech companies such as HPE and Instructure, to some of the world's most prominent higher education institutions, including Purdue University and Vanderbilt University. All right. So, Bassam, my friend. Again, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure, and it's nice to be in Park City. It's fantastic.
Yes. In fact, your offices are literally just a block
three
away.
3 minutes away. Yeah. I'm embarrassed that I drove. I just, you know, but.
you didn't bring your e-bike in today.
I should have. Yeah. I should have.
Yeah. I know that's one of your hobbies, one of the things you love to do.
I love that. In the summer, I've discovered that allergies can take me down for a few weeks. So I think we're coming out of that that season for me, and I'm excited to go back to it.
Very cool. Awesome. By the way, we're joining you from the Atrium at Kiln Park City. Super happy to have Kiln always as a partner, and obviously a really cool space here that we're in. Bassam, let's get a little bit more, let's start to get into kind of your story and your journey to start this segment off. I know because you and I know each other personally. In fact, our kids played soccer together, you know,
many years,
10, 12 years ago, starting 10, 12 years ago. We saw each other on the soccer pitch quite often, and started to spark up conversations when you were COO at different, different
companies and Merit CX.
Exactly.
I remember those days. That's crazy.
Long and out of town tournaments, you know, we'd be
that's right.
Grand Junction or Las Vegas, you know, Las Vegas in February freezing. Anyways, we've known each other for a number of years. I know your story, quite a bit, and you're somebody that I've always looked up to, admired, somebody that I've always followed because you're genuinely a really great person, a really great leader that has really high care factor, and somebody who I've learned so much from in my journey, that your depth of understanding of business and people and leadership and how that all intertwines it is off the charts. There are a lot of people that just simply don't have the acumen that you have on those fronts. And so I've followed you, I've learned from you, and I know your journey, fairly well.
I'm humbled by all those comments. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
My pleasure. And it's all absolutely true.
Thank you.
I know you were a schoolboy in Egypt, born in Egypt, your family went from Egypt to the UK, ultimately, ended up in Utah. You are an immigrant to the United States. You were an immigrant to the UK. If you can just kind of, give us an overview of your journey from childhood and how that led into the Sam Salem of today as the founder CEO of Mindshare Ventures and Atlas RTX. And just kind of tell us a little bit about that whole story, if you would.
I'll try not to bore everyone, but I was born in Cairo in 1972 to parents that I later appreciated were very, very, very unconventional. I didn't know it at the time, but I think I started figuring it out when I became a teenager. So one of my parents was an electrical engineer, and the presumption has always been that that's my dad, but it was actually my mom. My mom was an electrical engineer and was the person who first exposed me to computers. She'd come home with what were called Winchester drives, big, enormous drives in the 70s that you'd stick in IBM machines. And she'd have stacks of computer cards that had the programs on them. And so that was my mom in 1972 in Cairo, Egypt. My father was a colonel in the Egyptian Air Force, in the Air Force. We were raised traditionally for a few years, but when I was 4 or 5, my mother went to Paris to study, and I went with her, and we were exposed to the West for the first time. As you mentioned, a few years later, we actually went to the UK and lived there for a year and a half as my dad studied at a war college there, Royal Air Force Academy, and the whole family lived in what seemed like a mansion to me because it was a two-story home, something I'd never seen before. And they were just homes that we all got. And suffice it to say, I definitely felt like an immigrant in England. I certainly felt like an immigrant in France. But what was interesting, aside from learning about the West and the opportunities in the West, was when I came back, I felt like an immigrant even in Egypt. Because I spoke, English had become my first language. Our parents had sort of tried to blend and accept and adopt some Western traditions and some Eastern traditions. We obviously completely respect the culture we came from. But I remember sort of as a young teenager feeling like I spent my whole freaking life as an immigrant, whether in Egypt or otherwise. So when we moved to Salt Lake City in 1986, I was 13, just before my 14th birthday. I had sort of become accustomed to that notion of immigrant. Although I think it was arguably the most jarring immigrant experience.
Okay.
Salt Lake City in 1986 was incredibly uniform. It's much less so today.
Sure.
We lived on campus at the University of Utah student housing, which is now currently getting renovated and so on. But so we were on the east side of town, which was especially uniform, both religiously and ethnically and even socioeconomically. So going to East High School for a few years as an immigrant was tough. It was a very preppy school. Again, being a non-Mormon, brown-skinned immigrant kid who was poor, made for defining moments for 3 years in high school. I now want to run through, because I don't want to just keep telling you this boring story, but
it's not boring. Suffice it's it absolutely to say, fascinating. Take your time.
suffice it to say that as immigrants, my parents are academics, and their perspective to us was education is what will help you create a life here. So we were pushed to focus on education. That's all that mattered. Sports are fun, but it's education. Hobbies are fun, but it's education. And I distinctly remember that. So all of us, including my younger brother and sister, went through the University of Utah. And eventually, I completed 4 degrees at the university. My not so great joke is when you're the kid of an immigrant, you're supposed to either be a doctor or a professor. Those are the two paths.
Yeah.
In Egypt, law is not one that we think about. Certainly not finance. So it's doctor or professor. Okay. My sister became a doctor, and I was supposed to be a computer science professor. So I was on my path to computer science, although it was a tough one. It was certainly not an easy path. But then I eventually was able to get an H-1B with a local software company in the mid-90s. And that really sort of created my second path, where I realized, you know, I actually like this industry thing. This industry thing might suit me better. And I've been fortunate to build a career here in tech since the mid-90s. And I feel like the luckiest, one of the luckiest people on earth. I did not do anything personally to deserve being able to be in the U.S. I have many, many cousins in Egypt who are smarter than me and work harder than me than I would or could, and they're not here. And I think I benefited from the quality and quantity of opportunities in this country. And I think we so often forget how much there is here, how easy, with all due respect, how easy it is if you're just willing to put in some effort to make it in this country.
Yeah.
I'll stop there, because I don't want to put everyone to sleep.
No. This is all absolutely fascinating. And you are one of the things I've always admired about you. And one of the things that I connect with other leaders is when leaders who have attained great things learn and know how to still have great humility, right? And you embody that.
Thank you.
So, so the audience knows you're not looking at any ordinary guy here. And I know you would say otherwise, right? But to go through that journey of, you know, being an immigrant in three different countries, right? Landing, you know, in Utah in an environment that was not really conducive for you, that wasn't overly welcoming to you. And, you know, to do very well in your studies and then to become a senior executive, a C-level executive in some tech companies, some very good sized tech, you know, tech companies and startups, and to transition that into a founder and CEO, right? Those are no small feats.
Thank you.
Many Americans, you know, born in America, you know, struggle, you know, to reach those same feats and those same heights. And so I do want to acknowledge, you know, that and obviously certainly parents play a role in that, but it's not just about parents. It's about, you know, it's about a child who sees a vision and who understands, you know, that they want to make something of themselves and do something more meaningful with their life. And so But I want to come back around a little bit to, you know, and we'll come back to the story of Mindshare and of Atlas RTX here in just a moment. But you keyed in on something that I am keenly aware of. And I'm keenly aware of it because, and many people in the audience may not know this, but the mother of my three biological boys is Mexican. She immigrated to the United States. We met here in Utah, and were later married. My current wife, Angie, is Costa Rican. She immigrated to the United States, was in Texas for a number of years, came to Utah. We met after, you know, my ex-wife and I had divorced, and you know, she's Costa Rican, also an immigrant to the United States. My three biological children are Mexican American. My two stepchildren are Costa Rican American, both born in Costa Rica. They are immigrants. Of course, my boys were born here, but they are Mexican American. Both of my my ex-wife and my current wife Angie, they've both, and actually I have a lot of immigrant friends. In fact, for some reason in my journey in my life, I think that I've often connected more with people from outside the U.S. than I have from, you know, from native-born Americans, yeah, right? Yeah. Huh. So I have a lot of friends that are immigrants, and there's this theme that is always consistent for immigrants, no matter what pinnacles they might reach in this country or their home country. I usually find that most of them feel like, and no matter how long they've been in any country, they usually find that they're stuck in no man's land, that they don't really feel like they belong either here or there, right? They don't belong back home. They don't belong, you know, in the country where they've immigrated to, in the United States in this case. Can you maybe just expand a little bit on that and how that, you know, maybe shows up and plays a role in life?
Wow. That's a big question, but I appreciate the perspective and you're sharing your own experience there. I think I first really realized it in the early 80s when the first thing people would ask me, you don't see yourself that differently. Your inner eye is the same. You just see yourself like everyone else. But I would immediately get asked where I was from. I would immediately get asked, candidly, things I remember feeling like, that's a pretty personal question. Did you come here for religious reasons, or are you religious? Are you of the local religion, maybe? And I remember just sort of sensing like, can I just fit in? Can I just blend in and talk about other things? Because it was less about insecurity and more about it's not what I'm interested in talking about. It's not what defines me only. Although, let me candidly tell you that the older I get, the more my father's guidance to me as a kid comes true, which is the older you get, the more you'll appreciate that you are different. And I sort of sense that internally. I feel like one's appearance can sometimes get hidden and forgotten for a while, and then when something happens, suddenly it surfaces. So the story I'll hope I can quickly tell that I hope will make it feel real was I thought I was an American by the time the late 90s came about. I had been here for 15 years, early 2000s. I had established myself here. I had a job here. My life was here. I spoke English. I was fortunate to have been here young enough that I could speak it fluently without an accent. And then 9/11 happened. A horrible event. 9/11 was a critical moment, because instantly those who had been treating me like them started treating me as if I were different. I still remember to this day getting on the plane for the first time. I was a consultant at the time. I traveled all over the country. And as we all remember, you know, the skies were shut down for some time. And I remember that first flight going to visit a client and the entire flight completely going silent when I walked in. And admittedly, now that I have a clean shaven head, it's not quite as obvious as when I had my Egyptian hair. It made it very obvious. And I remember being nervous to go to the bathroom because I didn't want to stand up in the plane. I remember going to a client, it happened to be in Texas, where at the gate, at the entrance, the security guards had various pictures of Arabs with X's through them, some sort of FBI list or something like that, and giving me a dirty look as I walked in and feeling insecure. So it was almost as if in a matter of a couple of weeks, you remember that your identity is skin deep.
Yeah,
people suddenly saw me differently. That was a really tragic moment for me because it made me realize that that could happen at any time. At any time, I could lose that integration.
And you're already well into your professional career. You're an executive at this point. Are you a COO?
Not quite. Okay. That happened later. Yeah. But yes. I mean, I had a professional career and
well respected. You know, you weren't just anybody. You know, and not that.
I'd like to think that anybody deserves that.
I agree.
Anybody, 100%. You know, we shouldn't judge someone by the way they dress or anything else. And in many cases, I mean, certainly, you know, one of my common themes is when you ask someone about their identity, in the top five or six things, they will likely mention their nationality. They'll likely mention I'm an American.
Yeah.
They'll likely mention the religion they were raised with.
Mm-hmm.
They might mention some tradition or something like that as part of that identity. And my contention is, isn't it strange that we select things that we didn't choose as our own identity?
Mm.
I was born in this country, therefore I'm an American.
Yeah.
I was born in a Catholic family, for example. I wasn't, so I'm a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And those become so core to our identities and we'll fight for them,
yet
we didn't choose them. Just like the Egyptian didn't choose it, and neither did the Libyan or the Frenchman, and so on. So I think it's really strange that we judge people based on the things they don't choose and completely disregard the things they do.
Their
choices in life, their actions, the way they talk, how they treat people, what they achieve in life, what they do and contribute to society, that seems to come second to what we quickly see at a surface level to identify someone.
Yeah. You know, these perspectives are so incredibly valuable. And you got a little emotional. I'm getting a little emotional thinking about your experience of, you know, 9/11 and suddenly who you are in this country changes, right? And boarding a plane and even being in fear to stand up and go to the restroom because what are people going to think, right? And is somebody going to try to jump on me or
exactly.
You know, yeah. That's a very intense experience and one that I think many of us who are native to whatever country we're native to, in my case, you know, the U.S., there's just no way to have a reference point for that, right? And no way to appreciate that until you hear the stories, right? And you understand. And even at that, there's no way for us to have lived it and to really connect on the level that you have. It's more than apparent to me that you know, those experiences have also and the deep thought and work that you've done as a result of those experiences have defined, you know, the man who stands in front of us today, the leader, you know, the CEO who stands in front of us today. And it's apparent to me that that's, you know, one of the reasons why you are a leader with deep, deep empathy, right? A leader who sees and understands the humanity in business and people. That's something that I value deeply. It's something that often is missing, right, in business. And so I appreciate that. And I want to acknowledge that.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course, buddy. So let's talk a little bit about how that's led to Bassam Salem now, coming from a successful career as COO, and deciding to venture out on your own, right? And do something on your own and forming Mindshare Ventures and how that becomes Atlas RTX. And maybe tell, you know, the guests a little bit about what Atlas RTX is, and, you know, feel free to plug, you know, this is your opportunity to tell the story of your business and the problems you solve, right?
This will feel a lot less emotional, a lot less, less sensitive. I had been fortunate to have built a career initially in the, we'll call it mid to late 90s as a software engineer, early 2000s as a consulting and operations manager and director, and then later as an operations executive, as COO at a few companies. And I think by then I was in my mid 40s, and I was having a midlife crisis, sort of appreciating I'm in my mid 40s, 50s not that far, and 60s right around the corner. What do I want to do with my life between now and the end of my career? And I had seen myself as a great number two. I sort of felt like I was great to partner with an entrepreneur. I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneur. I'm not crazy enough. I'm not the visionary, artistic, creative, pie in the sky guy. I'm the spreadsheets and graphs and diagrams and process, and, you know, I'm boring.
Engineer minded. The immigration, you know, the background of immigration probably, maybe I'm speaking out of term, but maybe makes you a little more risk averse, right?
Actually, very, very good point.
Yeah.
Very, very good point. In fact, my biggest fear about taking a leap out of this traditional path where I was being rewarded was, what am I going to tell my immigrant parents who gave up everything for me to now be in this fancy white collar job, being paid tons of money with a big team and assistants. And I almost felt guilty. Yeah. Like, why would you quit that? Why would you give up what you've been able to achieve? And I really felt, I was afraid.
Yeah.
Even as someone in my mid 40s, I was afraid to tell my parents. My wife, who has not just been my best friend, but the one who has constantly told me it was possible and believed in me, positioned it as, why don't you do something for a year? Just take 1 year of time, and this is the best piece of advice that I was ever given. Nothing is forever. Just think of it as a chapter, and at the end of the year, you can revisit and do something else. So I decided that for 1 year, I would do what I was really passionate about. And what I was really passionate about is that inner professor in me came out, and I loved coaching and mentoring younger ops folks. My specialty was operations and product. So I thought, I'll spend a year just being a consultant, potentially working for free if they couldn't afford to pay me. And if they could afford to pay me, I'll make it nominal. Excuse me. And I'm going to form Mindshare Ventures, and I'm going to leverage other sort of, let's call them seasoned executives from in finance, in CTOs, you know, a variety of chief product officers. And I'd bring these folks with me, and we'd go help entrepreneurs succeed. That was really the genesis behind Mindshare Ventures. But I very, very quickly realized, you know, one, I'm only working 30, 40 hours a week, and I'm an immigrant. I need to work 50 or 60 to feel like I'm busy. Mm-hmm. And second, I felt in a sincere way, imposter syndrome, because I had never been an entrepreneur, yet I was advising a 28-year-old entrepreneur with zero revenue. I'm an $8, $10 million guy, and take it from there in revenue, $8 to $10 million in revenue and up.
Yeah.
So I'd done that multiple times.
Yeah.
So I thought, all right, if what I am doing and all the guidance and frameworks that I'm building are any good, I should be able to create, incubate a company within Mindshare Ventures and actually have it succeed. So that was the intention behind Atlas, believe it or not. And the A is the first company. So the name was not even, I need to come up with a really cool story for the genesis of the name. But that was really, let me build a company and do it the right way, the right way. Let me have it be about people in a real sense. Let me bring in co-founders. Let me not get on a financial, treadmill, a financial treadmill where we raise money too early and then blow up in 18 months. And let me really do it right.
Yeah.
And then use it as a role model for future Mindshare Ventures and for future guidance. And I would now suddenly, oops, sorry about hitting a mic. I will now suddenly have firsthand experience. Yeah. And that was really the genesis of the story. And after year one, we had hit the milestones and my wife jumped in and we kept going. And we have now, this is year seven. We have a great team here in Park City. And we have amazing clients, many Fortune 500 companies. I'm actually proud to say that, I'm sorry, we didn't correct it beforehand. We were at 7 out of the top 20 builders, for example. We're up to 10.
Wow.
And we have a number of other higher ed institutions that we support, including Emory University and Fordham. So we've got we've built a really, really, really cool company. I'm really proud.
That's amazing. And
thank you.
To have, you know, that level of client, you know, is a significant accomplishment, right?
Thank you.
Oftentimes it takes startups much longer than 7 years to get to that point. You start, you know, taking down the smaller, you know, opportunities first, and then work your way upstream. And that we're still in that process, and you know, SMB through SME at Nexus IT, and we're starting Absolutely. To look at our enterprise plays, and that's 24 years in, right?
So, good for you. I don't know if I could do it for 24 years. That's impressive. Yeah. I now have an appreciation for how hard being an entrepreneur is. Yeah. So I sincerely have empathy, appreciation for you. I think those of us who are in the field, shall we say, operators working for a company that's venture backed or PE backed or whatever, mm-hmm. I think we think of ourselves as entrepreneurial. This is a hard job. Being a COO or a CTO, it's a hard job. Is it really that much harder to be your own entrepreneur? My goodness, it's not even close.
Yeah.
The burden that you as an entrepreneur carry, the loneliness that everyone talks about, but no one appreciates until you're there.
Yeah.
The sense of helplessness sometimes, and the sense of overwhelm sometimes. I now understand that. I've experienced it. It's so much easier to be a COO at a $200 million company.
Yeah, that's one of the things about your story and your journey. And I know you spoke about this. You know, I've seen you speak about this on more than one occasion, that there's a significant difference in being a hired executive and being the entrepreneur, founder, investor, your money
good
on the line.
Yes, right? Exactly.
and CEO of the organization, right? Maybe just talk a little bit more about that and, you know, how that's been so much different and what you've learned a little bit there.
Yeah. I really appreciate that. That's actually one of the principles I'm really passionate about, is this epiphany that as founder, I want to be, the metaphor I'll use is the grandpa. I just want to be nice to everybody and take the kids out to coffee and ice cream. Not coffee, ice cream. I'm a coffee guy, coffee, but take them to ice cream and pat them on the back and, you know, be the kind, supportive, only positive person. That's what a founder seeks. And I'm sure you Absolutely. Understand that.
Yeah.
As CEO, it's a tough job. As CEO, you have to be the parent, to continue the metaphor. You have to be the parent. Someone has to say, no, I know that would make everybody happy, but it's the wrong thing for the company.
Yeah.
That's a tough role. That's a tough role. And now how do you balance being the parent with this desire to be the grandparent? You can't do it concurrently. Wouldn't it be nice if I could be the grandparent, I could let someone else be the parent?
And that's only significantly more amplified when you're bootstrapping out of your own pockets.
Which then brings us to the third role,
yeah.
which I now have a sincere appreciation for as an investor. And I'm just going to be, you know, I think we've seen the style here. I'm going to be blunt about it and transparent. As an investor, you're essentially, I don't want to call it on the other side of the table, but your objectives are to optimize and maximize the enterprise value of what you're building. And to do that, you have to put a lot of pressure on the CEO and therefore on everyone else on the team. And it's a very, very different thing. It's less about all the soft, fluffy leadership stuff we all talk about and more dollars and cents. And that is hard. Every dollar you spend is a dollar. I'm sure you remember the early days in your business. I still remember writing a check from our family's checkbook.
Yeah.
We didn't have payroll.
Yeah.
And you pay the person and you're like, wow, that's a big check. Am I getting that kind of value out of it? And that tension suddenly really puts a different perspective on things. So you combine being an investor with being the CEO, with being the founder, and we have got a serious problem. It's really tough to balance it all.
Yeah, yeah. It's a wonder we don't all go insane.
It's true. It's multiple personality disorder.
Yeah.
And I'm sure my team feels this way. Which Bassam are we getting today, right? Which is it going to be the grandpa, the parent, or I don't know what the metaphor for the investor would be.
Yeah, and really for the founders that are joining us out there, first of all, we understand this dynamic and the journey. I've been on it for almost 24 years.
Wow.
Bassam now for 7, just first of all, this is why the power of a circle, a power of a network, a power of friends. Bassam and I, every now and again on a Saturday morning, we'll grab coffee, sit down, just commiserate with each other, and talk
give
about
each other a hug, you know?
Yeah. And I know you do that with a lot of founders, which I appreciate, that you extend your open arms to other people, to help founders in their journey and to navigate, some of the difficult waters. And maybe for those that aren't founders out there, we try our best, none of us are perfect. And I think most founders that I know, deeply are good people in their hearts, right? And they're trying to produce the right outcomes for everybody and the right experiences for everybody, right? And sometimes you just can't make the stars align exactly how you want. You can't be the grandparent. And that is a difficult place for us to be in. So what I'm saying is cut us some slack sometimes, because the pressure is real, and frankly there are times where many of us are on the edge of breakdowns, and I've had dear friends who have had very severe breakdowns because of the pressure.
Absolutely.
When it's your money, you're bootstrapping it, you're the founder, you're the CEO, or you're one of the senior execs, right? And you're part of that founding team, right? It's no joke. It's difficult.
You're absolutely right.
So, which by the way, this conversation, you and I could go on for hours, I think, your story and your journey is so fascinating to me. And I think, of so much value for so many. And I know we've taken a good amount of time. In fact, we're about 40 minutes in right now. But I do want to shift a little bit and talk a little bit about how your journey has lended to your appreciation for DE&I, diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. Let's talk a little bit about that first, and then we'll talk more about the impacts of that and why is it important if it is, right? So part of that first. Yeah.
At some point, I think it was in my mid to late 30s, I realized that there were a couple of key moments in my life where a single person made a decision that made it possible for me to be here. So there are two people I want to publicly recognize. The first was, it was 1993. I was finishing my CS degree at the University of Utah. I graduated. I did pretty well. I wasn't the very top of the class, but I did pretty well. I thought I could go to graduate school in computer science at the U, and I should be able to get in because I, after all, graduated there and I was a pretty good student. Suffice it to say, I was utterly devastated when the University of Utah rejected my application. And I went into the graduate advisor and asked, hey, what happened? I'm a pretty good student. Look at my grades and my references. And she explained that because I'm a foreign student, I'm on an F1 visa, I get evaluated against a completely different pool than American students. And after all, we're a state university, and I love the University of Utah, by the way, and I'm in fact honored to be on the board now, so I love the university. But that was a shock to me. And so compared to all of the immigrants who were applying, I was not that great. I was just okay. So I was rejected. And a professor by the name of Lee Holler, who had taught me a couple of classes, heard of my plight. I didn't approach him. He heard of it. He called me into his office and said he was going to do something about it, and that if I would work for him this summer, summer of 93, that he would see what he could do. I worked my butt off that summer because he gave me a chance of a lifetime. And it's thanks to him that I didn't lose my visa, and I would have been forced to go home. My visa would be, and suffice it to say, Lee Holler changed this person's life. He could have given it to any kid for whom it wouldn't have made a difference, but because he gave it to me, it made a difference. I'm not going to repeat a similar lengthy story later in my career, but at one point, as a good technologist, I thought of myself as an individual contributor and one who would become a rock star individual contributor at 50, not a leader, because candidly, those of us who were computer scientists and who were immigrants were always seen back then as individual contributors. Back then, there were no Indian CEOs of tech firms like we have today. That didn't occur. We were stereotyped. We were siloed. And Michael Resnick at Siebel Systems, who first said, you know, Bassam, I think you could be a leader. I'm going to put you in this role and have you be my right hand. And I'm so grateful for Michael Resnick because he taught me I could be a manager. I wasn't great at it, but I could do it. So now we jump forward and realize, oh my gosh, these people can change other people's lives. So for me, DE&I is not about how does that help a business, or why our business is going to do better. Who the hell cares? Pardon my language. That's not what's important. What's important is what's the right thing to do. Do we owe it to people to give them a chance? Do people deserve a chance? People who want to work hard, do they deserve a chance? That in and of itself is enough for me. Do I believe it does help a business? Absolutely. Who wants to work in a business where everybody looks the same and talks the same and believes the same? Yes. Do I believe, therefore, that those businesses will do better? Yes. But that is not the reason I do it. And today I'm so incredibly passionate about it because of my own experience. I want to be the Lee Holler or the Michael Resnick for others. I want to be the person who gave people a chance.
And you have been, by the way.
Thank you.
You have been. And I've seen that in your journey. In fact, again, you know, this, your life experience has created this deep empathy for humanity, right? And a deep empathy for potentially the underdog, right? And I've seen that actually in the way you recruit, in the way you look for interns, in the ideals and core values of your organization and your 4 H's, right?
Thank you.
What are your 4 H's? There's hungry,
happy, humble, hungry, and horsepower.
Okay, happy, hungry, and horsepower. Yeah, that's what you look for. And I know that when you find a candidate that embodies that, you're not overly concerned about their experience and their background and their education. And those four things are the qualifiers. And from there, you will take them under your wing and under your team's wing and teach those people and give them a chance.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I sincerely, while they sound like a nice marketing characters. I really, really believe in them. I think, and I'm more so today than I ever did. If we really distill it down, I really believe that those four ingredients define the perfect person you want to bring into a team, any type of team.
Yeah.
Happy people are not toxic. They're grateful. Happy people are bring up the energy in the room instead of bringing it down. It doesn't take many unhappy people to destroy a culture. Humble people. No one needs a know-it-all. No one care. I don't need a know-it-all because they're going to be the same person next year as they were last year. So I want humble people. Even if they don't know much today, humility will allow them to grow. And then hungry. You're a founder. I'm a founder. The bar is high when you are building a team. I don't need to build a lifestyle business. I don't need to build a lifestyle team. I want people who want to be all in and grow. And this is what they're focused on. This is what they want to do. And those folks are few and far between. So when we find them, we give them a chance. Yeah. Horsepower, I sort of leave to Leanne because candidly, horsepower is one that in most cases is sort of innate. And I don't like that about it because it's the one trait that is really hard to change in someone. Mm-hmm. We meet people with incredible horsepower and you're like, if you can add those other three attributes, nothing will stop you. So happy, humble, hungry horsepower.
Yeah. The interesting thing is if all you have is horsepower and you don't have those other three traits, you're probably not the right fit to really join a growth minded team, you know,
exactly.
That's in a significant growth sort of business. Right.
Exactly.
I've seen with your journey, you do these summer internships specifically with immigrants. And remind me the criteria there. I know there's a criteria of. Go ahead.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. We have a number of programs. The first is really for high school students who are immigrants and hoping to go to college, who may not be exposed to what working in the business world is like. They may not have had that opportunity. Their parents may have never been able to expose them to it. So we love bringing in what we call our Salem Scholars, where we give them a scholarship towards their university education, and we expose them to what sales is like, what marketing is like, what engineering is like, so they can have perspective before they go to college. But likewise, I'm really proud to say that over the last couple of years, we've now hired what we call apprentices post-college. We have a number of them with us, started with us, who are folks who came like me as foreign students and finished an MBA at the U or a master's in finance or something like that, who need someone to help sponsor them beyond that. So despite our small size, we will take happy, humble, hungry folks from any country who have graduated here and who need someone to give them a chance. So we do have that as well.
Yeah. It's so cool, you know, to see a leader in a team who has taken a very mindful approach to how you create a positive impact that's beyond just, you know, providing employment and a paycheck and a 40-hour work week, right? But how do you really spread your net wider, you know, and do something meaningful for people, right?
Thank you.
I see that. I acknowledge it.
Thank you.
I honor it. So
thanks very
thank
much.
You for, you know, for being that type of leader, that type of individual. It's commendable, right?
Thank you. And yeah. Others were that for me. So I really feel it's only fair, but I've been given so many chances.
Yeah. Maybe let's talk, and we've got about 10 minutes left here. By the way, Diane Moore, who's joining us, says she loves the four H's, and so do I.
Right. Thanks, Diane.
If you're not following Bassam on LinkedIn or any other social mediums, do it because I learned so much from you.
I
really do. You've always got nuggets that are just like, why didn't I think of that?
No.
I'm 24 years into this thing. Why didn't I think of that? You know? Let's go back just a little bit. You arrive, in Utah as an immigrant, in very much white picket America, a religious community that you and your family were not part of. You were immediately, and I don't want to use the term incorrectly, but you were immediately outsiders, right? In the community. And maybe let's talk more about where you are today and where, you know, your hometown that you live in now, Park City here, right? Tell us a little bit about maybe the role of diversity and inclusion in community, not just business, and what that means to you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Maybe I'll to try to connect it personally. You know, one, in an attempt to integrate when we came here, one of the things I'm really proud of about my parents is, yes, we should immigrate. Yes, we should go and challenge ourselves and grow elsewhere. But no, we shouldn't just take everything that we have with us and force it into the new world. Let's take and keep the best of what we have, and let's integrate here. So I'm really proud of that approach because I think it allowed us to be open, less defensive about things, and more willing to adopt. One of the things that I, in some ways, I regret is my parents allowed us to take on Western names, shall we call them, Western names for professional reasons here. So I picked the name Mark from a TV show I liked, and my younger brother picked Steve Austin, $6 Million Man, another TV show. My sister happened to be a Maggie already, so she didn't need a Western sounding name. But I distinctly remember sending out resumes as Bassam Salem versus resumes as Mark Salem. When I'd send resumes, by the way, as Bassam Salem, suddenly it was Bassam Salem. Mm-hmm. When it was Mark Salem, suddenly it was just Mark Salem. I would get interviews 8 times out of 10 under the Mark moniker. I would almost never hear back under the Bassam moniker. And that was distinctive for me. Because it sort of taught me how the world worked. I regret that it took me until 2002 when my son was born to do away with my dual identity and go back to Bassam. So now going to the question you asked is how important is diversity in a community? And I really believe that we need to find a good way for folks who come overseas to bring the richness and color and energy of their local place. And we should accept them and let them exercise that. But I also think it's fair of them to hold themselves accountable to needing to integrate, to trying to integrate. And it's tough to put that bar on the immigrant because in some cases, the environment around them is not accepting. Mm-hmm. So they're forced to just go find people like them who will accept them. Wouldn't it be great if we could get the best of both worlds, where there is acceptance and people could blend in, and we could really create the so-called melting pot? It creates really vibrant communities. Let's get the best of everybody and bring it together. And I hope we can create places where no matter the spelling of your name or how hard it is to pronounce or where you come from or how you dress, that we can just bring the richness in and integrate it.
Yeah. There's so much there, right? So many very, very wonderful points. I think, you know, for me, the thing that I want to kind of wrap up here and then maybe just a final question as we wind down the hour here. But that is that whether it's business or whether it's community, you said it earlier, in looking at diversity, looking at people of unique backgrounds, unique orientation, unique colors, whatever it might be, right? First of all, recognizing the humanity in each one of us and just doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. You know, a good friend of mine, a musician that I've lost contact with, sadly, mm-hmm. and I need to reconnect there, but you know, he used to say we're all five finger beings, right? And we're the same, right? You take the skin off and we are the same, right? And besides that, you know, for me, variety is the richness of life, you know, taking all of those ethnic and cultural traditions that are so, and we've lost so much of that in the U.S. We're a melting pot, right? And so we've lost some of those really unique, deep cultural traditions that are so beautiful when you travel and you go other places and you see the heart and soul of people that are so deeply connected to a culture that dates thousands of years back, right? That's beautiful, for one. Two, you know, as tech leaders in Utah, I know many of us, and not just tech leaders, but many business leaders in Utah, are champions of diversity. We are trying to create, not just within our organizations, but within the community, an environment where all can thrive and where fairness and equity is a given for all, right? Because it does make for a more beautiful, thriving community and a more, you know, a business that thrives, right? Diversity of thought, diversity of background, bring more voices to the table that help solve more problems quicker.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you for, you know, of course, sharing your life story and how these concepts all, you know, kind of have played a role. As we wind down the hour, you know, again, just want to thank you, you know, for being my distinguished guest, for being a friend.
Thank you. Thank you for yours.
Being a mentor, you know, directly or indirectly. I think you're a mentor to many people you don't even know you're a mentor to. You know, the fact that you're willing to take the time on mostly a daily basis to share some thoughts, right, online and put yourself out there, put your heart and soul out there, which isn't easy. I know I'm an introvert,
hard, isn't it?
You know, and I'm not as good at doing daily as I once was. Just Nexus IT is in a very aggressive growth mode right now. And
right.
And I oftentimes don't have the time to, you know, put some thoughts out there every single day. Right. I do want to get to one more question and we'll go over the hour, just a few minutes, but, I wanted to thank Mallory Lovestad, who's our director of marketing behind the camera today, making sure that everything's working. So thank you, Mallory. Yeah, appreciate you being here with us.
And smiling at us from time to time. I appreciate it.
Anyways, just a final question. This, you know, this very intriguing journey you've been on, you know, from Egyptian schoolboy to France, to the UK, to the United States, to engineer, to executive, senior executive, to founder, investor, CEO, right? What do you think is the greatest lesson you've learned? And it can be life or business. What's the greatest lesson you've learned? And what would you like to share with the audience that you think would be of value as some parting words?
I'll keep it brief and I'll go to the four H's again. I think seeing so many high horsepower friends and acquaintances and colleagues over now decades not achieve their desired potential, what they wanted to achieve. The missing ingredient tended to be humility. Very smart people always think they're right, even though they might be wrong a little bit of the time, but that little bit is what distinguishes making it and optimizing from not. So I think for myself, I'm constantly trying to, at the end of the day, ask myself, what things am I not being humble about? What things did someone tell me today that that might actually be right, even though I disagree with it? And I struggle with that because it's tough. You can't spend all of your time doubting yourself, but you have to spend enough time to make sure that you're improving. And I will tell you, there have been both personal and business positions that I have changed as recently as this year, my take on. Meaning, you know, I used to hold this philosophy and I now need to be humble enough to say I was wrong. And I do that. I did it in a meeting just before I came here where I told the team, when you first suggested this to me, I want to acknowledge, I told you guys, I don't think this is a good idea. I was wrong. You guys are right. And I'm glad you pushed me to appreciate that. So I think I'll leave it at that, but focus on humility because I think it's a tough one.
Yeah, that's such great wisdom and advice there, you know, and as an effective leader, most definitely. In fact, yesterday I was in two meetings where I had to say I was wrong and I'm sorry, and I specifically know business leaders that would say that humility is a severe weakness in business, right? I, like you, believe that humility is a superpower. Being able to understand and know that I'm not right 100% of the time. I'm just human, right? And my way isn't always the only highway. And that's why you surround yourself with amazing, talented people who care and, who, again, bring diverse voices to the table.
Absolutely.
So that you can understand where your blind spots are and why there might, why your perspective may not be 100% accurate or just needs to shift, so take that home for all the founders that are with us or all the leaders that are with us. Humility is a superpower and Bassam Salem said it. So it's true. Look, we want to thank everybody for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to have my esteemed guest and friend, Bassam Salem, with me today.
Before we go, though, yeah. I want to thank you for the positive energy that you always bring every time I've ever met you, everywhere you go, and for being the guy I can count on, because there have been multiple occasions where I've reached out to you for help, and you've immediately been the person to jump in and say, I'm here for you. And I think that says a lot. So thank you for always being that for me over the years.
I really appreciate that. That's very, very kind of you. We thank you all so much. Remember that we've got some really amazing segments of Tech Beat coming up with some other really fantastic leaders. Tune in for those. Look for, the announcements on those. We're going to go ahead and sign off here of Tech Beat today. Thanks for joining us. We're out.